Health insurance premiums for individual plans are pushing some Alaskans to consider dropping coverage.
Who can afford this? I mean, who really can afford it? I can pay it, but I can't afford it.
From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, October 27th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaska schools wait for test scores that should have been delivered early this month.
We've had some frustration with our vendor. We think that these kinks should have been worked out sooner.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
The Affordable Care Act was supposed to make health insurance accessible to all Americans. But in Alaska, the high cost of premiums on the individual market has some residents considering dropping their coverage. Prices in the state have increased as much as 90% in the last 2 years. Open enrollment begins this Sunday. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Gunnar Ebbesen is used to paying a lot for health insurance, but the small business owner from Fairbanks got a shock recently when his quote came in for next year's coverage. The premium for his family of five came to more than $40,000 a year. That's for a bare-bones plan with a $10,000 deductible.
Who can afford this? I mean, who really can afford it? I can pay it, but I can't afford it.
Ebbesen makes a good living. He doesn't qualify for a subsidy to help pay for insurance because his family income is over $142,000 per year. But he isn't rich. He says paying for insurance that amounts to more than his home mortgage has forced him to make sacrifices.
I mean, I'm not able to put money in retirement. Savings for my kid for college, for my 10-year-old. Believe me, I could find lots of stuff to do for my future with $40,000.
Ebbesen supports the Affordable Care Act. He calls Alaska's rates a wrinkle in the law that need fixing. Alaska has the highest cost individual health insurance in the country. The average 2016 premium for a 40-year-old in Anchorage is $719, more than double the national average. Most Alaskans who buy individual plans qualify for a generous subsidy that rises with premium increases. But about 5,000 Alaskans are paying full sticker price.
We want people to have access to affordable coverage, and that's not happening right now in the marketplace in Alaska.
Eric Erling is a spokesperson for Primera Alaska, one of the two companies who offer individual health insurance in the state. Erling says even at those high premium rates, the company is losing millions of dollars on the individual market in the state. He says there aren't enough customers to absorb the high cost of medical care for some Primera members. Erling says in the first 6 months of this year, 37 customers filed over $11 million in claims.
Now, the important thing is they deserve access to coverage, and we're glad they have it. The trick is creating a sustainable environment where those costs can be absorbed in a way that doesn't adversely impact all consumers.
Primera is drafting legislation to reestablish a high-risk pool to insulate the individual market from those outsized claims. The program would be paid for with a tax on all health plans in the state. The company is working with MOTA, the other insurer on the individual market in Alaska, to develop the legislation. The state's Division of Insurance is helping with some of the details, but Director Lori Wing Heyer says she won't take a position on the idea until she can review the bill.
Yeah, we want to see the individual rates stabilized so that people can afford them, there's no doubt.
Wing Heyer is more focused on another issue driving up premium rates, the high cost of health care. The price for some specialty care in Alaska is double or triple the cost of the same service in Seattle. Wing Heyer says she wants to work with doctors and hospitals to come to an agreement that would ensure more reasonable rates.
You know, there's room for everybody to make a living in the medical field, but we have to get the rates to, at some point, people can afford them.
Victoria Cronquist doesn't care what the solution is as long as it helps her find more affordable insurance. This year, the Anchorage resident is paying $1,600 a month for herself, her husband, and two kids. The rate is going up to $2,600 a month next year. Her employer, a dental office, gives her some money each month to defray the cost, but that amount isn't rising with the premium.
It's just getting too expensive. I'm up against the wall. I can't do it all.
Cronquist is considering dropping health insurance. Her family has been uninsured in the past, and she paid the price for that decision when her daughter ended up in the ICU. Still, she says going without insurance may be the best option.
To be quite frank, to have a $2,600 monthly premium payment and all this is stressful to me, extremely, and that increases my odds of getting ill. That's the other way I look at it.
The high rates will push more Alaskans into a category that allows them to avoid paying the penalty for not having insurance. The law includes an unaffordability exemption if the lowest cost insurance amounts to more than 8% of your income. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Another member of the president's cabinet is coming to Alaska. Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter revealed this morning that he'll visit the 49th state someday this week. Details are scarce, but APRN's Liz Ruskin gleaned a few, and she reports on Senator Dan Sullivan's attempt to press Carter on a recent incident in the South China Sea.
Secretary Carter let slip his travel plans at a Senate Armed Services hearing after agreeing with Senator Dan Sullivan that the military should have a serious operation plan for the Arctic.
I appreciate the fact that you are a champion of that and can consider me a supporter, and I appreciate it. And we'll have a chance to actually discuss that in Alaska later this week.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
And that was it. A Pentagon spokesman confirms that Secretary Carter will visit this week and says they'll release details in the coming days. Mike Anderson, a spokesman for Sullivan, says the secretary expects to land in Fairbanks. At the hearing, Sullivan asked Carter to confirm news that the U.S. sent a ship into waters China claims for itself. Carter was oblique.
We have said, and we are acting on the basis of saying, that we will fly, sail, and operate wherever international law permits.
Did we send a destroyer yesterday inside the 12-mile zone of one of the...
To do that, there have been naval operations in that region in recent days.
When Sullivan was done, Senator John McCain pressed Carter further, saying it's frustrating that Carter is keeping mum about a known operation.
Something that is all over the media and confirmed by everyone, and you come before this committee and say you won't comment on it? Why?
I'm going to not be coy with you. I don't like in general the idea of talking about our military operations, but what you read in the newspaper is accurate.
Sullivan is a critic of what he sees as the Defense Department's inaction in parts of the globe, including the response when Chinese military ships were spotted last month within the 12-mile territorial zone off the Aleutians. U.S. defense officials called it innocent passage. Sullivan says it was more like provocation. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The state has begun calling witnesses in the Fairbanks for evidentiary hearing. As the proceeding stretches into its fourth week, the focus has shifted from witnesses summoned by attorneys representing exoneration petitioners, George Fries, Kevin Pease, Marvin Roberts, and Eugene Vent, to those offered by state lawyers trying to uphold the men's convictions for the 1997 murder of John Hartman. Yesterday, Fairbanks resident Stephen Pascvan testified that he gave Eugene Vent's mother, Ida Hoag, a ride to the airport shortly after her son was arrested for the Hartman attack. Pascvan recounted a brief conversation in which he says Hoag shared something Eugene told her.
That he assured her that, and that, "Mom, I never got out of the car."
The comment presumably references a car Vent and the other three men allegedly rode around the city the night Hartman was assaulted on a downtown street. Hoag testified she does not remember the comment and doesn't know Pascvan.
I never spoke to him.
Also yesterday in a video deposition, cab driver Veronica Solomon recounts seeing four men around a car at the scene of the Hartman attack about the time of the assault. Solomon says she tried unsuccessfully to report it to police a few weeks later, but avoided news about the case until 2005 when she looked up a picture of the Fairbanks Four.
Marvin Roberts clearly to me looked like the person I was standing by the door. And I think it was Kevin Pease. He's the light-colored person. I think I remember his name as being the one that looked like the person by the driver's door.
Solomon describes a car different from the one the Fairbanks Four are alleged to have been in the night of the Hartman attack. Solomon says she shared her story with a state trooper reinvestigating the Fairbanks Four case last year. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a community well project turns into a pilot for infrastructure development in rural Alaska.
You know, basically this metal pipe, it quote unquote, went back to nature.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal Housing Lender, Member FDIC. And by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
School districts across the state are waiting on standardized test scores that were scheduled for release in early October. 3rd through 10th graders took the Alaska Measures of Progress tests for the first time last spring, but finding out how students did on the new exams is taking longer than expected. KHNS's Emily Files reports.
We've had some frustration with our vendor. We think that these kinks should have been worked out sooner.
That's Alaska Department of Education Commissioner Mike Hanley. The state has a contract with the Kansas-based Achievement and Assessment Institute, or AAI, to develop and score the new AMP tests. Hanley says when AAI gave the AMP scores to the state recently,
we weren't happy with, we found some glitches in some of the data, the way it transferred to our reports.
Hanley says the glitches had to do with the way scores were differentiated and scaled. For example, in reading, the AMP tests measure different skills.
One is reading for information. One is reading literature. We should be able to see a different score for each of those. And because of the way it was scaled, we couldn't see the differentiation between the two, and yet we know there is one. They're both reading, but they're different skills.
I mean, I do take 100% responsibility for that.
Marianne Pieri is the AAI's project manager for the AMP contract. She says there were a few unique things about the Alaska tests that posed challenges which AAI should have been better prepared for.
We weren't used to the kinds of checks that are needed in your state. For instance, there are a lot of transfers in Alaska within the testing window. We had several kids that actually changed grade levels in the middle of the testing window. So we had quite a few kids that had duplicate scores.
The back and forth between the state and the testing vendor has left superintendents hanging.
It's frustrating from a district standpoint to get ready and then get let down.
Rich Carlson is interim superintendent for the Haines School District. He's worked as a superintendent in Alaska for 14 years and says he can't remember this kind of delay ever happening in the past.
It's been very confusing because we have been ramping up for the release of the scores and the public release for probably 4 or 5 months.
Superintendents in districts including Haines, Dillingham, and Wrangell have warned at school board meetings that students' scores for the assessments are likely to be lower than those from previous yearly exams because AMP standards are more rigorous. Here's Commissioner Hanley.
So that's where the anxiety, I think, is. That's what's being held up, and that's what we'd like to just get out there and share with parents and share with communities and schools, so we can move on and kind of get a better understanding around it.
And there's another concern. Alaska, like many other states, saw an increase in opt-outs with the new standardized tests. In school districts like Haines and Sitka, testing refusals jumped from almost none to numbers that will likely affect district scores significantly. Hanley says the delays happening now are probably not going to help that situation.
Yeah, it's not going to build confidence. I don't know. It's hard to say how it'll impact, you know, people, you know, more people wanting to opt out.
And the delay is not building the commissioner's confidence in this new testing vendor. AAI has a $25 million five-year contract with the state of Alaska. Hanley says if it seems the institute won't be able to deliver on that contract, the state will have to make a choice.
You know, you expect some glitches in the first-time rollout. I didn't expect this kind of delay, though.
Hanley doesn't know how much longer the delay will last. In Haines, I'm Emily Files.
Over a decade ago, Oscarville's community well broke down. Then this summer, the school well quit working too. Last week, the community landed a major grant to fix both problems. The funding is part of a larger vision for rural Alaska and could pave the way for additional infrastructure. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur has more.
In August, the Oscarville school staff showed up at school, ready to begin the semester, and found the building's well had collapsed.
You know, basically, this metal pipe had, quote-unquote, went back to nature.
That's James Mikesell. He's the plant facilities manager for the Lower Kuskokwim School District, or LKSD, and manages the district's wells.
We have very ferrous, iron-bearing soil all through Alaska, so you put a piece of metal in the ground and it's going to rust away.
To prevent the school from shutting down, Mikesell and his crew mobilized. They emergency shipped a 500-gallon tank and a high-volume pump from Anchorage and loaded it all on the LKSD boat
that we lovingly call the Ark,
which they drove to Nambuskiak, located across the Kuskokwim, and back to Oscarville.
And that had to be done on a daily basis, at least one or two trips a day.
Meanwhile, the school was limiting its water use, and Mikesell and company were rigging an alternative solution. The village has two wells, the community well and the school well. The community well collapsed in the early 90s, and residents have been using rain and river water ever since. The school well water is restricted to school use. The community and school district have never merged resources to fund and manage one water well, so the community and school have never shared a water source. That might change. Oscarville recently landed a federal grant of almost $500,000 to rebuild their water system.
What this has done is opened up the opportunity for the school to share their watering point with the whole community, which has not happened in the past.
Jackie Schaefer is a project specialist with design company WH Pacific. She's helping facilitate what's being called the Oscarville Pilot Project. Last year, about a dozen organizations from across the state came together to figure out how to make life better in rural Alaska, which means safer, more comfortable, and less expensive. They want to see how community development can happen as a whole instead of through siloed projects, and how that process can empower communities. Ultimately, they want to replicate the system across the state. The team designated Oscarville, located 5 miles from Bethel, as their test case.
The holistic approach is really to change the perspective of how we do community development and allowing the community to start seeing how these components all tie together.
Those components include power, housing, transportation, waste, and water.
So it's everything that binds that community together.
This recent grant is bigger than just water because it could help develop additional infrastructure by acting as a match to future grants. But before any of that can happen, the school needed to fix its water issue. Mikesell and his team salvaged the old community well and stretched a 400-foot pipe from that well to the school's water treatment plant to provide the school and two faculty houses with water for the winter. The solution is temporary. The well could break down and the line could freeze.
We've done everything we can think to do to try to insulate that line from cold temperatures. But there's no guarantee with Mother Nature how cold it's going to get.
If the well fails this winter, then it's back to hauling water from Nebuskiak. The school district and community have from now until spring thaw to figure out how to merge water systems. Meanwhile, the pilot project crew will be working in Oscarville this winter, increasing energy efficiency in the town's 20 buildings, changing electric meters to deliver lower cost electricity, and hoping the school's water pipe doesn't freeze. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
Broken hips and head injuries can have life-altering effects, especially for older adults. But no matter how old you are, it's important to be physically active to prevent injuries. Activity can also increase your strength, balance, and can be done at any age. Ask your healthcare provider about activities that will improve your health. Learn more about starting a new activity at injuryprevention.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
A 2010 federally sponsored study is the first to deliver a reliable count of the Kenai Peninsula's brown bear population. Last week, a Kenai National Wildlife Refuge biologist explained the study during a presentation at the Pratt Museum in Homer. The museum is preparing to launch a new summer exhibit all about bears. KBBI's Quinton Chandler has more.
The number of brown bears on the Kenai Peninsula fell from about 582 to less than 500 between 2010 and 2015. That's according to John Morton with the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge.
It has to do with the fact that the harvests have been liberalized by the Board of Game since 2012, and so our harvests are higher in the last couple of years, in particular 2013 and 14.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the U.S. Forest Service paid for Morton and his team to spend part of their summer counting brown bears using a method called mark recapture. Mark recapture is pretty much what it sounds like. The researchers caught the animals, marked them, released them, and then they tried to recapture the animals they'd marked. Morton's team marked the bears by collecting their hair and analyzing their DNA.
And the key here is that it's not the number of animals that we find, you know, that we detect with DNA, it's actually our recapture rates. And that goes into a model, and then we base our population estimate not on the total number of bears we detect, but actually on the recapture rates of the bears that we mark.
Morton says before this count, there had never been an empirically based population estimate of Kenai brown bears. The dense tree cover on the peninsula makes conventional aerial surveys impractical. Morton's presentation was only the first on a schedule for the Pratt Museum's upcoming exhibit on bears. Scott Bartlett, curator of exhibits at the Pratt, plans to throw the work of scientists like Morton in with works by local artists to create a vibrant exhibit. He admits even he doesn't know exactly what the end product will look like.
Because we don't know what the, you know, what all the content from the talks are going to be and what all the art's going to look like. I think the broadest description is it's going to look like an art exhibit. So, and then there will be some supporting interpretive content drawn from the presentations.
Bartlett hopes local artists will be inspired to create pieces that reflect the facts provided by the guest speakers. This way, he believes the exhibit will manifest a range of different perspectives.
You can explain a subject with narrative and data, or you can interpret a subject with art. There are just different ways of understanding the same topic, the same themes.
The exhibit will be on display from May 6th through July 31st, 2016. No artwork has been submitted yet. Bartlett asks that interested artists confirm their participation by March 1st. In Homer, I'm Quinton Chandler.
A group of Wasilla girls is using social media to shoot for the stars, or at least Hollywood-style stardom. Dance Team Alaska has already gotten one big break, and as KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, they are back in the valley and waiting for offers.
Taylor Swift's irresistible earworm shook the nation this summer. It's also the music backing Dance Team Alaska's YouTube video that aced out 2,000 others in an audition competition for a new reality show. Okay, before you groan, another new reality show, take a moment to think just how hard it is to stand out in the crowds of people trying to get noticed for a show called Dance Battle America.
And so when we did it, we didn't think that it was going to really go anywhere. We just did it to have fun. And they picked us out of thousands of auditions. They picked 8 teams, and ours was one of them.
That's Courtney Milslagle, the only member of the 5-person Team Alaska who is out of high school. She appeared on the Jimmy Fallon show a couple of years ago, and since then she's set her sights on showbiz. Courtney enlisted her sister, Penny Wotaya.
I was super excited about it. When we heard about this whole TV show, we were totally excited. We knew that we were perfect fits for this.
Courtney choreographed the moves, and the group shot their audition tape on the Matanuska River Bridge in June. Cousin Sierra Kistler jumped on board.
We went to Walmart because it was super last minute. Like, she called me up, she's like, let's do it right now. So I was like, okay. So we went to Walmart and we bought some, we wanted it to represent Alaska. So not only did we do it on the bridge in Palmer with the mountains and everything, but we went and got some camo shorts.
Mm-hmm. And we bought a camo umbrella that was one of the props that we used.
We wore hats that were camo hats.
And it worked. Team Alaska was chosen to appear on the show's pilot production. They shared the stage with groups like Liquid Feet, a trio which turns deliberately bad dancing into comedy, and a trifecta of high-stepping sexagenarians called Silver Classics. The show aired live on ABC in September, pairing sets of dancers against each other.
My boys, energy!
And from Wasilla, Alaska, here are my girls, Team Alaska!
The Wasilla team danced well, dressed in fuzzy fur boots and lots of icy blue and silver glitter. One of them, wearing a bear costume, did the worm, a move applauded by show choreographers.
The audience has voted, the results are in, and the winner of the battle.
Alas, viewers' votes chose the competition, a shirtless men's team called Energy, as the winner of that round. A post-show wrap-up, aptly named After Buzz, summed it up.
Team Energy brought a pull to their dancing, though.
That's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, they worked it. And Alaska was, like, the opposite end of the spectrum. They were, like, the cutest, sweetest,
so
innocent.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, fame is fleeting. And Dance Battle America? ABC hasn't decided yet whether to pick up the show beyond the pilot. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Emily Files in Haines, and Ellen Lockyer in Palmer, and Quentin Chandler in Homer. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Ron Zastro. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
And by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Alaska Pacific University is proud to announce 2 new bachelor degrees, Alaska Native Governance and Creative and Professional Writing. Learn more at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.